Portland on 90.7 FM.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, remembering Jimmy Carter, the good, the bad, and the presidential. Also, Nora Barrows Friedman reports from the Electronic Intifada about some of the latest acts of genocide and mass killing in occupied Gaza. And we'll feature a new commentary by Kathleen Johnstone. Awakening from the Empire propaganda begins with one small act of heresy. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting today from San Francisco, and we are happy to have you along. Usually, we broadcast the newscast from the Electronic Intifada on Wednesdays, but that is going to change, and we will now feature it on Thursdays. It is Thursday. This was recorded on December 30th, but the information is crucial and you haven't heard it anywhere else. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 451 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here is a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week. Since the beginning of October, more than 80 days ago, we've been reporting here every week on the relentless targeting of medical workers, patients, and staff of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia as Israel accelerates its ethnic cleansing operations and complete obliteration of Palestinian life in North Gaza. And for more than 80 days, the hospital's director, a pediatrician named Dr. Abu Safiya, has pleaded with the world to stop Israel's genocidal attacks on his hospital, his staff, and his patients. This past week, Israeli tanks and armored quadcopter drones continued to lay siege to the hospital, which was the only partially functioning medical center left in the north. It now lays in ruins after the Israeli army stormed the building, forcibly ordered everyone inside to leave, interrogated and strip-searched staff, and set fire to the hospital. Here are the developments from the last week of attacks on Kamal Adwan. Israel deployed remote-controlled vehicles to place boxes of explosives around the hospital, according to eyewitnesses. Drones were filmed dropping bombs on the hospital itself. On December 24th, Dr. Abu Safiya stated that, quote, something new was developing in terms of Israel's attacks on the hospital. Here's a clip from Dr. Abu Safiya's statements on December 24th when he spoke from inside a hospital ward. In this video, he says, quote, explosive robots began to approach little by little and two robots detonated near Kamal Adwan Hospital. I believe they were around 50 meters from here. Unfortunately, these explosions, as two robots were detonated, resulted in massive damage to the hospital. This is the situation, he said, as a bomb dropped by a quadcopter exploded nearby. Quote, we get bombarded by these bombs all night long.
طبعا هذا هو الحال كما ترى الآن قصف من كواد كابتر شكله قريب جدا على بوابة المستشفى هذا هو الحال طوال الليل نقصف بهذه القنابل
On December 25th, Israeli attacks on Kamal Adwan killed five hospital workers, Dr. Ahmed Samour, a pediatrician, Isra Abu Zaida, a laboratory technician, two paramedics, Abdul Majid Abul Al-Aish and Maher Al-Ajrami, and Faris Al-Hudali, a maintenance worker. On Friday, Israeli soldiers ordered patients and medical staff to leave the hospital. Some patients were transferred to other medical facilities. Here's a video filmed from inside Kamal Adwan Hospital. A woman says to the camera, quote, "All I can say is may God hold them accountable." Israeli forces also ordered the entire medical staff to strip off their clothes, march to a nearby area, and undergo interrogations before some of them were abducted and taken to unknown locations. An eyewitness stated that Israeli soldiers forced all the patients and displaced people to walk a long distance to a checkpoint, where they were subjected to hours of humiliation and invasive searches before being loaded onto trucks, still without clothes, and left to sit for hours. The eyewitness stated that everyone, injured, sick, displaced, or visitors, received the same degrading treatment with no regard for their conditions. Soldiers had also marked Palestinian captives with numbers on their necks and chests. Shuruk Saleh Harer Al-Rantisi, a lab worker at the hospital, told reporters that Israeli forces ordered the female hospital staff members to remove their shirts and pull down their pants. They also ordered the women to remove their headscarves. Quote, "When we all completely refused to do so, they said that those under 20 years of age should take them off. We all still insisted that we would not take off the hijab," Al-Rantisi said. She added that they were grabbed by the neck while their IDs were checked, and then the soldiers searched everyone. Al-Rantisi added, quote, "I was surprised to see that they, the Israeli forces, were burning the archives," adding that after that, the army called on Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya and he went outside. He came back and told his staff that the army wanted everyone out of the hospital. A physician in Gaza, Dr. Izzadine, stated on social media that some of the medical staff, quote, "were later transferred to the Indonesian hospital, a facility that had been cleared of displaced people a week ago. Hours later, a few of our colleagues were released from the Indonesian hospital, but were subjected to another round of searches before leaving. We were unable to confirm the names of those released, so we went to the hospital to wait for their arrival and ensure their safety. Thankfully, many of them have been released and we were able to speak with them. Unfortunately, some of the medical staff, including the hospital director, were taken to an unknown location and their fate remains uncertain." On Saturday, images emerged of Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya being ordered to walk toward two tanks outside of the hospital to talk to the soldiers inside the tanks. He was subsequently abducted and reportedly physically assaulted by the Israelis. A nurse, Walid Al-Budi, gave his eyewitness testimony on Dr. Abu Safiya's abduction and abuse by Israeli soldiers. I'll let the video play and read the translation over it. Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya was arrested from Al-Fakhura school after he had stayed with us and refused to leave, even though they told him to and that he was free to go. He told them that he wouldn't leave his medical staff. He took all of us and wanted to get us out at night, but they yelled at him and arrested him, a man of great humanity. We appeal to the entire world, all of the world, all of the human rights organizations, to stand by Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya, the great man, the man who planted within us and within our hearts patience, so we can persevere in our steadfast north. I swear we wouldn't have left willingly, but by force. We cried blood on the doors of Kamal Adwan Hospital when we were forced out by the occupation army. As of this morning, Dr. Abu Safiya has been effectively disappeared by the Israeli army and his exact whereabouts are still unknown. There were reports that he was seen being beaten with batons and electrical cables by Israeli soldiers. The Gaza government media office stated on Sunday that, quote, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, along with his colleagues in the health system, bore the burden of defending the right of patients and the wounded to receive treatment and medical care, and remained steadfast in the field of work despite his severe injury and the loss of his son Ibrahim, who witnessed the sacrifices of this steadfast family. The reports that Dr. Hussam Abu Safia was subjected to serious violations and psychological and physical pressure after his arrest, including being forced to take off his clothes and medical coat and being used as a human shield, constitute a blatant violation of all human values and international conventions. And we call for immediate and serious action from all concerned parties, especially the international community and international and UN humanitarian, legal, and human rights organizations. Dr. Abu Safia, as we've reported, had refused incessant orders by the Israeli army to abandon his hospital. In late October, Israel raided and besieged Kamal Adwan, killing Abu Safia's 15-year-old son, Ibrahim, in a drone strike. Abu Safia led the funeral prayers for Ibrahim before burying him in the hospital's courtyard. At the time, he accused the Israeli army of killing his son as a punishment for refusing to abandon the hospital and his staff and patients. A month later, Abu Safia was injured in another drone strike, shredding his leg with shrapnel and leaving him seriously wounded. But he declared, quote, "This will not stop us. I was injured at my workplace, and that is an honor. My blood is no more precious than that of my colleagues or the people we serve. I will return to my patients as soon as I recover." Just last week, as our contributor Fida Al-Kedra reported, Abu Safia insisted that transferring patients as called for through an Israeli loudspeaker would take days, not hours, if it was even possible. The Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia, he said, would have to be prepared, and there was a lack of ambulances to transport patients. Quote, "Once again, as on so many occasions in recent weeks, he appealed to an unlistening world," Fida Al-Kedra writes. We'll continue to update the situation at Kamal Adwan Hospital and Dr. Abu Safia and his staff and patients as best we can. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza stated on Friday that, quote, "It is worth noting that three public hospitals were covering medical services in the northern Gaza Strip, namely Beit Hanun Hospital, the Indonesian Hospital, and Kamal Adwan Hospital. Beit Hanun Hospital was completely destroyed, and the Indonesian hospital is completely out of service after the destruction of all infrastructure. The only hospital that was partially operational due to the lack of medical capabilities and supplies was Kamal Adwan Hospital. What is happening today is that the occupation has dealt a fatal blow to the remaining health system in northern Gaza. And this is completely consistent with the general's plan to end the presence of the population in the northern Gaza Strip," the health ministry stated. Israel attacked three other hospitals in northern Gaza this weekend, including Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital and Al-Wafa Hospital in Gaza City and Al-Awda Hospital in Jabalia. Israel continues to repeatedly attack the tents of displaced Palestinians in so-called humanitarian safe zones in Gaza. On December 22nd, Israel massacred at least seven Palestinians in a bombing of Al-Mawasi, setting the tents ablaze. And this week, at least five newborn babies have died from hypothermia in displacement camps, including Al-Mawasi. The oldest child, Juma Batran, was only 1 month old. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported that, quote, "Thousands of Palestinians displaced from their homes have been living inside nylon, plastic, and makeshift tents along the coast and in the central area of the Al-Mawasi evacuation zone, where it gets really cold at this time of year. The fear is that this is going to worsen as weather forecasts warn of a cold front hitting the Gaza Strip in the coming days." The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza announced that a physician, Ahmed Al-Zaharna, who worked at the European Gaza Hospital, died from hypothermia on December 27th. His body was found inside his tent in Al-Mawasi. Israel killed five journalists this week in Gaza. The Gaza government media office says that the number of reporters and media workers who have been killed since October 2023 now stands at 201 after Israel bombed the press van of the Al-Quds Al-Yom satellite channel at about 1 a.m. on December 26th, burning five reporters alive while they were working in Nuseirat refugee camp. Their names were Faisal Abu Al-Kusman, Ibrahim Al-Sheikh Ali, Muhammad Al-Ladah, Fadi Hassouna, and Ayman Al-Jadi. Al-Jadi's wife was in labor at a nearby hospital with their first child when he was killed. The baby was born a few hours later and was named after his father. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights called the missile strike on the media van, quote, the worst crime against journalists in Israel's genocide in Gaza Strip. The group said, quote, Israel, by targeting journalists, aims to monopolize the narrative and orchestrate a media blackout to prevent the world from seeing the atrocities committed against the Palestinian people while denying international journalists access to Gaza to cover the genocide. All of this is part of a full-blown genocidal campaign and other international crimes attempting to entrench a second Nakba against 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip for over a year. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of When a Medic Found His Mother's Body by Mustafa Taysir Al-Burai, a journalist in Gaza. Mustafa profiles a 29-year-old medic, Abdul Aziz Al-Bardini, and his harrowing story. Quote, stationed at a medical check-in point in Al-Burej refugee camp, Abdul Aziz received an emergency call about an Israeli airstrike targeting a civilian vehicle in Al-Maghazi, another camp in central Gaza. Without hesitation, he and his medical team rushed to the scene, navigating through rubble and chaos to respond to the cries for help. We arrived within 3 minutes, he recounted to the Electronic Intifada in November. The airstrike had hit a civilian car with two missiles. The wreckage and injuries were horrifying. Abdulaziz immediately began assessing the victims. He treated three injured children, one of whom was in critical condition, and a woman who appeared lifeless. The children were my priority, he explained. Two of them had moderate injuries, but one, a 10-year-old boy, was in a dire state. He was bleeding internally and vomiting blood. My sole focus was to keep him alive. While Abdulaziz was working to stabilize the boy, bystanders carried the woman's body to him, saying she was already dead. He checked her for vital signs and confirmed her death. I covered her respectfully and placed her on the medic's seat in the ambulance, he said. There was no time to inspect her further. I had to focus on saving the living. The ambulance raced to the hospital where Abdulaziz carried the critically injured boy to the intensive care unit. After ensuring the child received immediate attention, he returned to the ambulance to retrieve the woman's body. Still unaware of her identity, he asked the attending doctor to confirm her death. I told the doctor she's alone. Please register her as an unidentified victim, Abdulaziz recalled. The doctor confirmed she had died and Abdulaziz prepared to leave. However, a strange feeling compelled him to look at her again. I can't explain it, Abdulaziz said. Something inside me told me to take one more look. He uncovered her face and his world came crashing down. It was my mother, he whispered, tears welling up. Her face was different because of the shrapnel wounds. At first, I didn't recognize her, but then I froze. It was her. Shock consumed him. I stood there, not believing what I was seeing. I kept telling myself, this must be someone else's mother. Someone will come and say it's their loved one. But the truth was staring at me. Abdulaziz's mother had been struck by shrapnel that pierced her eye and exited through her skull, causing fatal injuries. Only hours earlier, she had prepared him tea and a sandwich before his work shift. Her last words to him echoed in his mind, take care, my love. May God protect you. Those are excerpts from When a Medic Found His Mother's Body by Mustafa Taysir Al-Burai on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing defiance and resilience in the face of Israel's campaign of destruction. A celebration for a newborn baby in the Rifat al-Arir camp for displaced families in Deir al-Balah was captured by the Samir Project, a local mutual aid organization. They state, quote, Osbo'o, meaning week in Arabic, is what we call the celebration of a newborn baby in Palestine. Aysel is the first newborn in the Rifat al-Arir camp who was born in late November, and we celebrated her arrival a week after she was born. We also celebrated Yazan and Maya's birthday. They are twins in the camp. The first thing we do in the Osbo'o is bathe the baby and put them on a decorated khurbar, or a tray. The mother then wears a traditional dress and has to do 7 turns carrying the baby and saying Bismillah in God's name. Meanwhile, another woman repeats phrases like, listen to your mom, listen to your dad, listen to your grandmother, etc. Typically, the kids chase the mother and newborn with long candles and sing songs to welcome the baby. Kids are given bags of sweets and plates of sumay'a are given out to everyone. The baby and mother are given gold or cash by close friends and family. We tried in Rifat al-Arir camp to celebrate the arrival of little Aysel with the sound of bombing in the background. And all we can do is keep fighting for Aysel to grow in a free Palestine. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And now we would like to feature a brand new commentary by Catlin Johnstone. She calls it Awakening from the Empire Propaganda Begins with One Small Act of Heresy.
Awakening from the Empire Propaganda Begins with One Small Act of Heresy. Escaping from the matrix of the mainstream Western worldview is like escaping from a cult. It starts with one tiny heresy, one small secret thought that goes against all your indoctrination. Maybe it's the realization that you've been lied to your whole life about Israel and Palestine. Maybe it had something to do with watching the mass media manufacture consent for the invasion of Iraq. Whatever it is, it starts out as a tiny little mental suspicion that the information sources you've been trusting to help form your understanding of the world might not be nearly as trustworthy as you'd been led to believe. If you talk to anyone who's ever left a cult, they'll generally tell you that it started out the same way for them. They see a sign that the cult leader claiming he's Jesus might actually be kind of petty and egotistical. They find themselves wondering whether Sri Baba Shiva really needs that many Rolls Royces. They question if maybe Pastor Jeremiah is saying God wants him to have so many wives for reasons that have a lot more to do with what Pastor Jeremiah wants than what God wants. These little heresies eventually add up and snowball into an avalanche which collapses the indoctrination that was keeping them in the cult that whole time. It actually tends to play out that way when it comes to leaving any psychologically abusive relationship. A little spark forms in the back of the victim's mind, questioning whether the thoughts their partner put in their head are really true, and noticing who would benefit if they weren't. Enough little sparks like that, and you eventually get a fire that burns the whole relationship down. These are the kinds of sparks we're trying to get flying when working to wake people up from the indoctrination of the empire. We're trying to get those first tiny heresies to form in people's minds, using whatever's happening in the news at the moment, or whatever relevant ideas are trending. We don't need to get anyone to wake all the way up in one go. We just need to get the snowball rolling. One little heretical thought can be all it takes to get someone seriously questioning whether everything they've been taught about the world is a lie. So we point out the lies wherever we find them. Any glaring plot hole in the official narrative, anywhere it pops up. Right now, Gaza is a constant deluge of information and raw video footage that can spark some major heresy if it is truly seen and ingested. The way we were just told to cheer for Syria being taken over by Al-Qaeda is another. The lies we were told about Ukraine and the events that led up to the war is another. Every day there's something coming up that you can show anyone who will listen to you saying, "See? Look at that. They lied. They're lying right now. I wonder what else they're lying about." And it just takes one. One well-placed spotlight on one obvious plot hole is all it takes to get someone pulling on a thread that will eventually unravel the whole matrix of delusion for them. And once they're awake, they can join us in helping to wake up the others. So make a vocation of being a serial blasphemer. Get people asking the inconvenient questions and spark as many small acts of heresy as you can. People are only going to awaken from the imperial narrative matrix one pair of eyelids at a time, and we each have the opportunity to spend some time every day trying to help open them.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're now joined by an old friend of the show. He's actually going to be in the Bay Area. We're going to be together. I'm looking forward to that. Joining us is Bob Bezanko, U.S. historian specializing in Vietnam and foreign policy and professor of history at the University of Houston. And we're going to be talking about Jimmy Carter. He has studied Jimmy Carter has written a lot about Jimmy Carter, and Carter is certainly an interesting president, and as an activist, post-presidential extraordinary. Professor Bezanko, welcome back to Flashpoints in this very, very crazy world, and you're joining us from Two Gun Houston. We're glad to have you back on Flashpoints. I'll be looking forward to seeing you in the Bay Area soon. Welcome.
On the 16th, January 16th at the Unitarian Church. So
give us that again. We lost you at the beginning.
I can't wait to see you. It'll be January 16th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church on Bonita Avenue.
Okay. I appreciate that. We'll mention that towards the end. Again, good to have you. Since we just played the extraordinary news report from the Electronic Intifada, let's start with Carter and the Middle East. He certainly distinguished himself from other presidents when it came to understanding, as they say, the Palestinian problem and paying attention to the Middle East. Do you want to remind people what Carter did, what his context was within the Middle East, with Egypt, and the significance?
Sure. Let me kind of go in reverse chronological order for a second. After he left the presidency, his work in the Middle East was really, really notable. And he did and said things that no one else ever did. He actually wrote a book referring to apartheid in Palestine. He won peace prizes. He brokered agreements and oversaw elections. Just a really incredible life. But while he was president, obviously, the biggest thing he did was the Camp David Accords in 1978, which at the time seemed like kind of a way forward. Now, 45 years later, it's a bit different. There had been, kind of attempts to get Egypt and Israel and Jordan and Syria and other states in the region together, especially after the 1973 war. The UN had two resolutions, 242 and 338, which had not been abided by. So Carter, kind of made a point to try to reinvigorate these peace talks. And in 1977, his first year as president, he traveled and met with Yitzhak Rabin, and then later Menachem Begin took over for Rabin, Anwar Sadat, Assad, King Hussein, and others in the region to lay the groundwork. And then he kind of, working behind the scenes, brought Sadat and Begin somewhat together. Sadat actually went and spoke before the Knesset, and that was all the prologue to the meetings outside Washington, at Camp David in September of 1978. Carter there, played a vital role. After a few days, Sadat and Begin didn't really want to talk to each other anymore, so Carter was kind of shuttling back and forth. And, at the end, after I think 13 days, nearly 2 weeks, they were all there, did come up with an agreement, which at the time, mostly created a framework to go forward. Specifically, it said that Israel would leave the Sinai. It made some kind of vague references to Israeli settlements and things like that. Obviously, looking at it later, there's not a great long-term benefit. There's just one thing, I'll let you talk in a minute, but I want to read this because this is from the actual accords in 1978, because I think it's really, really meaningful right now, right? This is a verbatim. This is a quote. Egypt and Israel agree that, in order to ensure a peaceful and orderly transfer of authority and taking into account the security concerns of all the parties, there should be transitional arrangements for the West Bank and Gaza for a period not exceeding 5 years. In order to provide full autonomy to the inhabitants under these arrangements, the Israeli military government and its civilian administration will be withdrawn as soon as a self-governing authority has been freely elected by the inhabitants of these areas to replace the existing military government. And I think in many ways that's the key point of that. It left it open. It didn't really address the settlement. So at the time, it was clearly, invigorating to see Sadat and Begin talk and to have this agreement and to discuss the framework. But the PLO was excluded. The Palestinians were excluded from this as well. So, you know, there was a great feeling, but I think in the long term, we look at it more as kind of it created a framework, but the long term results were not, you know, what we had hoped they would be at the time.
All right. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Robert Bozenko. He's U.S. historian. He specializes in Vietnam and foreign policy, professor of history at the University of Houston. And we're talking about Jimmy Carter. To become president of the United States, you essentially have to give it over to the corporations. Now, many have said that if Jimmy Carter would have been able to have a second term and had it undermined by what we will talk about, known as the October Surprise, he might have been the president that he was, as the person he was for that second term, as he became in his after presidency life. But tell us about Jimmy Carter and some of the significant structural problems that made progressives really, really angry. His policies weren't all that good, his economic policies. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's a little vignette. At one point, somebody was speaking to one of the major labor leaders. I can't remember which one. And a journalist said, what can Jimmy Carter do to help labor? And the labor president said he could drop dead. So it got really ugly by the end of his administration. He kind of came to some national notoriety, actually, because in 1972, he worked with conservative Democrats to try to stop George McGovern from getting the nomination. And then David Rockefeller and the Trilateral Commission kind of adopted him. He became very...
Hello? Hello, I think... Are you there, Bob?
Oh, yeah. Can you... I'm sorry. Can you hear?
You disappeared. I don't know what happened, but...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Start that one over again, please.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Carter came to national notoriety when he tried to stop McGovern he was part of a group to try to stop McGovern in 1972. He was part of the Trilateral Commission. David Rockefeller kind of took him around to meet people. As president, he really created kind of what we call neoliberalism today, even before really Reagan and others did. Deregulated a lot of key industries, especially airlines and trucking, which led to much higher prices and eventually lower wages. He really kind of instituted austerity programs, appointed Paul Volcker, the head of the Federal Reserve, which led to a massive interest rates and inflation far worse than what we had a couple of years ago. And I think in a couple of specific things, in 1977, when you started to see the factories in places like Youngstown and Detroit and Pittsburgh shut down, labor and others, including our friend Spot Lynn, was a big part of this, reached out to try to get the government to do something, to step in and save these jobs. And Carter wouldn't do anything. He didn't respond at all. And then in 1978, there was a United Mine Workers strike, which had been going on for about 90 days. And Carter invoked Taft-Hartley and broke the strike. So he was very much in that regard, very different, say, than from LBJ would have been, you know, the Democratic predecessor. So Carter really is the first president to kind of embrace these more kind of pro-government, deregulatory ideas, and essentially started to move away from the New Deal, which, you know, from 1932 on, pretty much every president had followed. So in that regard, yeah, he caught help from progressives. He even said at one point, he said, I think I feel more comfortable with a lot of the Republicans here than in my own party.
Yeah, he was a perfect setup for Reagan to usher in Reaganism, deregulation. Reagan comes in, deregulates the SNLs, and all hell breaks loose. Then comes the big banks. It gets even worse. But Carter set the tone and opened up those doors. He also invented, shall we say, the modern concept of the counter-revolutionary, which he introduced in the struggle to try and undermine the Sandinistas' rise to power in Nicaragua, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think Afghanistan is best known, and most people support that because it was, you know, this anti-Soviet thing. He did the same thing in Nicaragua in 1979 when the Sandinistas came into Managua. He actually convened a meeting of the OAS to try to get them to put together a multilateral military force to go to Managua to prevent the Sandinistas from coming, you know, taking over the government. And then he very quickly, very shortly after that, I remember it was kind of tucked away in a newspaper article, appropriated, you know, really a small amount of money, like $12-15 million, but for these Contras in Nicaragua to fight against the Sandinista government. That occurred very early as well. And then, you know, as we were saying earlier, this, you know, they weren't, even if they weren't called Contras, he was doing these kinds of activities all over the globe, you know, in that
all
region.
Over the globe, America, in Africa, where he later became a hero.
Right? You know, ironically, and this is one of the things, you know, to make it clear, like you and I think most of us, I really admire what he did, you know, as in his later life. It's really inspirational and unmatched. But as president, yeah, not so much. And you mentioned Angola or Africa, which I think is really important. There was a revolution in Angola in 1975. This group, the MPLA, a Marxist group, came to power. And South Africa didn't like that. So Carter and the South Africans and the Chinese, all three, worked together. They promoted this warlord named Jonas Savimbi. They did everything they could to try to prevent the MPLA from taking over in Angola. And MPLA finally did win this subsequent war in 1978, largely because they got significant support from Cuba. But Carter was on the same side as the South Africans and the Chinese in Angola. And then in Vietnam, Carter in 1977 said the United States didn't really owe Vietnam any reparations or anything because, in his words, the destruction was mutual. And I'm sure he regretted saying that because, obviously, you know, Vietnam had been destroyed in the U.S. The war wasn't fought in the U.S., so the idea that destruction was mutual was ridiculous. And then he started working with the Chinese to do two things, which is, again, you know, we don't know about, you know, not many people know about this. They supported the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia after the Vietnamese kicked them out. So in 1978, Vietnam intervened in Cambodia, put a government in led by Hun Sen. But Carter, and then Reagan as well, supported Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, including saying that they should have that seat at the UN. And then in 1979, Carter met, you know, had a communication with Deng Xiaoping and Chinese officials, and they discussed, and China went ahead with an invasion of Vietnam. So again, Carter's working with the Chinese against these forces of liberation in places like Angola or Vietnam. He supported the Indonesians against the independence movement in East Timor, and on and on and on and on. So there's a lot to that. But yeah, there was this kind of Contras or counter-revolutionary movement. And he's a typical American president. You know, Noam Chomsky often said every American president's a war criminal. And, you know, that fits, unfortunately.
Well, the point here is, at least as it looks, to be president, you have to sell out key aspects of your own soul. You have to pay attention to the corporate elite. I mean, we're seeing this in the extreme now, but this has not even been a slow creep. It's a medium creep getting very fast in terms of the power, the sort of military corporate power that now obviously is going to control the future of the world. And who knows where this is going. We're watching it very closely. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Robert Bezenko. He's a professor of U.S. foreign policy at the University of Houston. He's a specialist in Vietnam and in generally in foreign policy. We're talking about Jimmy Carter. We're going to invite you, Mike, if you could put up the phone number, because I don't remember it. We'd like to invite some folks to come in. If you have some thoughts on Jimmy Carter, you might want to ask the good professor here. I want to hit the... Many people feel that Carter would have been a two-term president, and some of that good stuff that we saw in his after-presidency would have been a part of his presidency. Hard to believe, but people have said that. But would you remind, let me give out the number, and then I want to ask you to remind us about the October surprise. The phone number, if you want to get in on the discussion, is 800-958-9008. That's 800-958-9008. 800-958-9008. We'd love to have you join the conversation with Professor Bezanko. We're talking about Jimmy Carter. We're talking about the October surprise. What do you think? That many people believe, and Robert Perry's investigation for Consortium News tells us that Carter was pushed out. The fact that, well, describe what the October surprise was in this context.
You actually, you know, probably know this better as well as anybody. You were, you know, great friends and colleagues with the great Robert Perry, who really did so much to uncover this. But the hostages were taken in late 1979, and, you know, it really started to create a drag on Carter's popularity here at home, his numbers. And in addition to that, you know, you had the oil
shocks. These were U.S. hostages that were taken.
Yes, and at the embassy in Tehran. And then that, you know, leads to another round of oil shocks and massive inflation, terrible inflation. And you have the Volcker shocks going on at the same time. And so Carter was working, obviously, very tirelessly to try to get the hostage crisis over, you know, because that was really, you know, a huge problem with his reelection campaign, and even actually tried a rescue campaign in the spring. I believe it was in April of 1980, where, yes, you know, it was a disaster. The American helicopters crashed. So it looked bad. But throughout the summer, you know, he continued to work. And there were some, you know, kind of rumors and news reports that they may be making progress. According to the October surprise theory, is that Reagan and his vice president at the time, George Bush, were concerned about that. Now, there's a little background to this. I'll be brief. But in 1968, Nixon and Kissinger did this in Vietnam. They made overtures to the Vietnamese to tell them not to agree to anything with Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey. They'd get a better deal. So moving forward, I believe they sent Bill Casey, who would later be the director of the CIA, on a secret mission to Iran to speak with the new Khomeini government there and essentially tell them that if they waited and didn't release the hostages, you know, before the election, while Carter could maybe use that to his advantage, that they'd get a better deal from, you know, Reagan and Bush. And I mean, obviously, you're never going to find a smoking gun document where they, you know, spell this out. But I remember at the time, after reading about it from Perry and others, it certainly seemed plausible, and I'm inclined to believe it.
Yeah. All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're taking calls at 800-958-9008. That's 800-958-9008. A good time to call is when somebody hangs up. We're going to be joined here in Berkeley and in the Bay Area by Mac. Mac, welcome to Flashpoints and Professor Bezanko. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I have to speak well of Jimmy Carter, because I certainly cannot picture Nixon or Reagan or Bush, you know, cutting wood and swinging a hammer for, you know, housing for poor people. But, you know, when he was a president, he wasn't always that great. And, you know, I remember when Three Mile Island melted down and we were, you know, wondering what was going to happen. He ran into the stricken facility, you know, which was brave, but also, you know, maybe not so smart. And I think he was a solid booster of nuclear, which, you know, those of us who study it know has got real problems. So, you know, I don't think he was perfect. You know, I think he, you know, mishandled Iran, and you know, he was hired to defend the empire. His best work was after he got out of the White House. I'll take a response to that.
Professor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what he did after he left the White House is within the context, almost unbelievable. I mean, it was just really, you know, inspirational. He, you know, to use the word apartheid in a book to describe Israel is, you know, he caught hell from that. The Democratic Party in 2008 withdrew, like, their request for him to speak at the convention because of that. Because they were getting, like, pressure from, like, AIPAC people and others, you know, Israel supporters and others. So, absolutely. I mean, you know, building, like you said, building homes, brokering elections. He won a peace prize for a nuclear agreement with Korea. You know, eradicating diseases, absolutely. But as president, yeah, you're right. I mean, he's hired to attend to the empire, and you don't get to that point if you're going to be, you know, kind of some kind of you know, anti-imperialist or something like that. So I think we should absolutely, you know, praise what he did after that. But I think it's also really important to understand what he or anybody else did as president, because we tend to look for heroes or, you know, mentors or something like that, and it's really hard for one person to do that. Even somebody who probably does have a good heart, like Carter did.
And what would you say? What stands out for you? What is the? What do you think made Jimmy Carter most proud? He certainly was a humble fellow. Bought his house in 1961 for $100,000, and they didn't do a thing to it. They just lived there, and they were truly humble folks, and that in itself, in this world, when you think about who's in charge now, is an extraordinary difference, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he was a citizen, you know, and that sounds kind of corny nowadays, but you know, he was a citizen, and he took that very seriously.
Absolutely. Let's get Ramin from Oakland, California. Ramin, join us on Flashpoints. Say hello to the professor.
Oh, hello, and thank you for your distinguished guest, and thank you for opening up the phone lines. I have two quick questions. Wasn't somebody behind the scenes in the Carter administration, and maybe the Bush-Reagan administration, was it, who was very influential, Zubensky, Brzezinski? And seems like he had a lot of influence in foreign policy. And mm-hmm. also, it's interesting that the U.S. Embassy hostage takeover in Iran, it happened earlier, and then they let everyone go. So it's kind of surprising that they let the embassy staff stay there for a second time, in which they got taken over again. That's kind of strange. Do you think they let it happen? Or anyways, thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. What was the question there?
Did they let the
embassy
stay there? Cause the first
they initially took the embassy over, but they did release, I think they released the women and black members of the embassy staff, and they kept the rest there.
I think that's the way it went.
And what's that?
Go on.
And I think one of the problems, too, is the Shah was very unpopular, and Carter continued to support him and even let him in the country for medical aid. I was going for cancer surgery at Johns Hopkins or something like that.
Supposedly.
And that was, I think, one of the things that really set this off. And he kind of had warnings. I think, you know, intelligence had told him that if he did that, you know, you could expect something to happen in Iran, and he dismissed it. So in that regard, the U.S. was a big supporter. The Iranians, next to Israel, were the biggest recipients of American aid in the region in that time. Between 1973 and 78, Iran got $19 billion in nuclear weapons from the United States. So the crisis, I mean, it obviously was because of America's support for the Shah, and then you have, you know, Khomeini took over, the U.S. froze assets and everything else, and it led to that, eventually the seizure of the embassy in Tehran.
Let's bring Marie in. Join us, Marie. You're on Flashpoints Pacifica Radio with Professor Robert Bozenko. Welcome.
Thank you. Would that be me, Marie Louise? Is that me?
That's you.
Okay, thank you. Well, yes, one of the things that for me has been something so important with Jimmy Carter is that he really knew how to be a human being. Yes. He wasn't on some other level. And so that was wonderful. And then I wanted to mention one thing he said at one point. It was having to do with nuclear power. And he said that his daughter had said that she thought that was going to be very, very dangerous and we really shouldn't have it. And she said that, and then he repeated it to the people, and then they made fun of him, saying like, oh, you know, he takes advice from a daughter who's like 14 years old. So they spoke like that. Anyway, of course, I totally approve of what she said, and that he said it. Again, he just was a human being. So that's really all I'm calling about. Thank you so much for having this program, and we will remember him.
Thank you. Thank you for your call, Marie. We appreciate your presence. We're taking calls on Flashpoints. We don't do it often, but I thought this would be a good subject. We've got Professor Pezanko standing by. Bing, you're up next. Join us on Flashpoints. Say hello to the professor.
Hello, Professor, and thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to follow up on the earlier caller who was mentioning the big new Brzezinski. Because that was a really terrible thing that he and Carter cooked up, you know, in order to entice the Russians into their own quagmire, their own version of Vietnam, because, you know, we paid for these anti-Western jihadists who through the decades eventually became, the Taliban, you know, and eventually became Al-Qaeda. It's a long story. It's, you know, it's a long twisting story. So I'm not going to say that there was, you know, that it went directly in that direction, but that's what, how we ended up with the Afghanistan we have today. And it's like, and it's never really acknowledged, just like it's never acknowledged that, you know, Clinton was responsible for 1.5 million deaths, you know, as a result of the sanctions in Iraq. We never talked about that. But one thing we never talked about the Carter, you know, is the beginning of the funding of anti-Western jihadists, who by the time the Russians moved out in 1989 were in total possession of all this technology by the CIA and weaponry of the CIA, and eventually became, I mean, not directly, but indirectly became Taliban. And then that ended up with the creation of Al-Qaeda, which was separate, you know, that was Saudi Arabian, you know, on the border with Pakistan. But it's like, I would just like to hear what the professor has to say about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. Would you got about a minute there, Professor.
Go yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. Brzezinski envisioned himself kind of as a Kissinger type, and actually went to the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan in December of 1979, and, you know, was looking at the Mujahideen, who later, as you point out, become Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and said, you know, look at over there, those are your mosques, those are your homes, and you're going to get them back because God is on your side. You know, so yeah, absolutely. And they began to fund that. The Soviet Union actually was intervening to protect a Marxist government against the more extreme and more radical communist government. And a lot of people in the U.S. even told Carter, including the great diplomat George Kennan and Cyrus Vance at the time, told him that, you know, let it go. And Carter really kind of insisted, you know, boycotted the Olympics and then began funding the Mujahideen and you know, so on. And really reinvigorated, ended SALT II. There had been Nixon and Ford were working towards arms agreements, and Carter walked away from it as well. Increased defense budgets as well, too. So great.
We're just about out of time here, and sorry to interrupt, Professor, but no. Looking forward, I believe we're going to be together. Remind us of the deal again. Because
absolutely,
continue this conversation with you.
Oh yeah, it's 2 weeks from today, January 16th. The doors open at 7 at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists at 1606 Bonita Avenue. You will be speaking. Nora Barrows Friedman, I believe, is the name, who is from. Well, she does stuff on you have her, and then she's with Electronic Intifada. I believe she's going to be.
She
speaking
started
as well,
on this program. She started. Yes. Her radio career here, we're proud of her. Yeah, go on.
That's why we thought of it. And I'll say a few words, and we're really looking forward to it, because, you know, Scott Parkin and I just, you know, think the world of you, and you're a real inspiration, so we can't wait to have this and meet. And so it's January 16th, 7 o'clock, Unitarian Church.
Thank you. We appreciate
thank you so much,
listening
Dennis.
To Flash. You're welcome. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
to KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community